Even as a young adult, I was pretty out of touch with my body. I was very mental. I lived either with my head in the clouds, daydreaming, or reading books and or playing the violin. Or so I was very, in my head. And it wasn't until, I did go through a lot of, some years of not being very happy, and finally did find the Alexander technique. It was like an answer to my prayers when I was feeling really down. And it was at a time where I was having neck pain, and it wouldn't go away. I went to doctors, chiropractors, nothing really helped. And then I went to Alexander technique lessons, and they really not only healed the pain really quickly, but I started feeling just incredible in my whole body. And emotionally, I was uplifted and happy and falling in love with life again. And it was a dramatic shift.
This is Unconditioning, discovering the voice within, with Whitney Ann Jenkins. Hello and welcome to the 68th episode of Unconditioning, Discovering the Voice Within, where I bring on guests and we talk about the inner authentic voice and the challenges and the rewards that come from following it. This week, I have with me Jennifer Roig-Frankley. She is an international prize winner and certified Alexander technique teacher. She combines her professional experience with a lifelong love of meditation and perennial wisdom. This unique combination gives her uncommon expertise in pinpointing the source of artists' mind-body issues. Jennifer has performed as a violin soloist in some of the most prestigious concert halls and with orchestras from around the world, including several appearances in Carnegie Hall. An international prize winner, she's been the concertmaster of multiple ensembles and has been featured in Time magazine. A former faculty member teaching Alexander technique at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music and member of Apollo's Fire, the Cleveland Baroque Orchestra. Jennifer's approach has introduced countless performers to powerful techniques for balanced mind-body coordination, improved musicianship, and renewed energy. Jennifer teaches online and in Cincinnati, and she gives workshops around the world. She has founded two professional associations for Alexander Technique teachers in Ohio, and in 2009, she designed and implemented a successful research study for surgeons using Alexander Technique at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, which resulted in a prize-winning paper presented at the American Academy of Pediatrics and published by the Journal of Urology. I had an amazing time talking with Jennifer, hearing her story and just learning from her wisdom of following her inner voice. So without further ado, here is Jennifer.
Questions? I was thinking about your interesting question about if there's anything you feel uncomfortable talking about. And about an hour ago, I thought, probably best not to talk about politics. So I could rather not go there.
Yeah, I think very rarely have we gone into that subject matter on this podcast. So
yeah. You never know. It kind of came up a little bit in another one, and I'm like, wait, let's not do that.
Yeah, I'm with you. So I just have like one question that I ask like at the start, and it's pretty organic from there. It's all about you and your story. So like there's no right or wrong answers anywhere along the way. So
it's like to kind of go with the flow and see what happens.
So, Jennifer, as your journey of life has taken you on the road as a musician to like guiding people who are musicians and artists now, there are a lot of things that you had to experience in order to be able to do that and guide people in their lives. So one of the first things that I like to ask my guests is, when was the first time that you realized that you had this inner voice of your own that was guiding you and you were able to recognize that it was like purely your own and something that you were able to follow?
That is a great question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to that. but I knew I wanted a violin when I was two.
Okay.
But I don't think I was conscious, you know, of that being me guided, me being guided in any way. I just knew I wanted that violin, and I got it when I was four, and I had no doubt whatsoever that that's what I wanted to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it wasn't until age 19 or so when I came into contact with a spiritual perspective on life, where suddenly I was able to see everything differently. And maybe that would be, that would qualify as a moment when I realized I was being guided innerly by some and externally by something greater.
Yeah.
That was me at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. But like to know something that confidently when you were 2 years old, and then to keep that going until you were four, like you were, that was like twice your age by the time you were two, and to keep that interest alive and then have that be the trajectory of years to come, like I think that's a really big kind of voice within you that you were listening to at of some level.
Yeah, and I think I was really influenced by my parents. They were musicians and used to play chamber music in our living room in the evenings when I was a baby. I would be sat there and I got to listen and watch. And my mother was a cellist and my father was a violist. They're both musicians today, but my mother now plays clarinet and okay. My dad plays viola and trombone and some violin. But they were not violinists, and yet I fell in love with the sound of the violin, I think, when they were playing quartets. And I guess I just liked the melody.
Yeah.
I still like the melody.
You stayed within the string family, at least.
Yes, that's right. Although my boyfriend is a percussionist and a composer, so.
There you go. Okay. All right. So do you remember what it was like when you first picked up the violin after like desiring to want to do that for so long? Or was it just something like naturally within you?
I don't remember that at all. All my earliest memories are, you know, from photographs that somehow keep alive some of those moments. And I remember early Suzuki group lessons with other kids and teachers. And I have a lot of memories of those group fun times with other kids and practicing with my mom. You know, I don't know if you know much about the Suzuki method, but or for your listeners, the traditional way of learning the Suzuki method, the parent actually learns the instrument with the child. So my mother was not a violinist, but she picked up the violin to learn mm-hmm. it along with me. And so she was basically my teacher every day, except once a week I would go to the violin teacher and also to those group classes. So I have really good memories of making music with other people.
Yeah.
But then also from a very early age, I just loved being a soloist.
Yeah. That means, so you had a sense of community within the music as well as mm-hmm. allowing it to be a voice of your own, perhaps.
Yes. And I think that got lost a little bit along the way, where really my drive to be a soloist was strong and kind of took over. It was, I was pretty competitive. And so I was very early on better than the other kids, or most of them. And my mom entered me in competitions from the time I was young. And I just thrived on that. And I don't know if it was a good thing or not, but that's the way it was for a long time. And so being, you know, playing on my own, doing my own thing, being the first violinist or the soloist, kind of standing out, that came naturally for me. And it was more interesting than the group experience for a long time. I always had fun in the groups, but it was partly competitive, I have to admit too. And then it wasn't until much later where I was in ensembles, mm-hmm. Where it became something more communal and equal with everyone else, much healthier in a way.
Oh, I totally get that. So did you struggle with discipline at all when it came to your music, or was it something that you just felt motivated at all times to chase after?
I hated practicing. I have always hated practicing. I can't say I hate practicing now. I just don't practice. That's the truth. It's a long story. But no, it wasn't like I resisted it. I was quote unquote a good girl and did the things I was supposed to do. And I really had a very strong drive for the goals of being a violinist. I was thinking long range. Even from the time I was really young, I wanted to grow up and win the competitions and win the jobs and become the soloist and famous international soloist. And I just was really clear on what I wanted. And so then it was also clear that I needed to practice and, you know, carry out the steps necessary to get there. And thankfully, my parents were, I feel so, so fortunate with the family I grew up in. My parents were really loving and very, very supportive. And they had an understanding of the music world, even though, like, my dad was an English professor. He was an amateur violist. My mom became a professional Suzuki cello teacher, actually, inspired by the Suzuki method. But it was, I don't know. I'm losing my train of thought now as I'm starting to go down memory lane.
No, you're fine. So as far as like a classical musician goes, you're kind of like keeping the traditions alive of composers from the past. Is that a fair way to put that?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, most of my, basically as a kid and a teenager, that's when I was really focused on becoming a soloist. And I was a classical violinist exclusively. I came into contact with the early music world when I was doing my bachelor's at Indiana University. So yes, all old music except for, you know, contemporary composers that we would play sometimes, but mostly older music, it's true. And my favorite composer has always been J.S. Bach, who, you know, was around in the 1700s. So
yeah.
But to me, I've never really thought of it as old music. Because it's coming through me and I am making it something fresh and new every single time it comes through me. It's never the same way twice.
Yeah. So you're finding your own voice within that tradition.
Yes. And yet I also had, I made a video, I guess, when was it? Maybe 8 years ago, something like, no, it must have been 7 or 8 years ago, where I started dabbling in gypsy jazz violin.
Oh yeah, I love that. Yeah.
I've always loved other kinds of music, but my profession has always been classical. But I started just fooling around with some gypsy jazz, and there's one YouTube recording that I have of the minor swing, which was just so much fun. And I keep thinking I want to do more of that. And yet I am not in practice mode, so nothing happens. I made a solo violin CD during the pandemic. That was my 50th birthday gift to myself during the pandemic. Okay. And since then, I think I've had one performance. So since 2020, I performed the Four Seasons with Chamber Orchestra of Pittsburgh. Oh, nice. And that was really fun. That was in June, a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And since then, I just have had zero interest in performing, and nothing happens unless I have a goal. So.
I think as performers, we kind of go through like cycles like that of like, we're really into it at some points and then we have to like take a break. And I think that's kind of natural.
Yes. And my break has been really long. I really haven't practiced seriously for many, many years, except in spurts. And everything changed when I was 19, and I really did completely drop my solo ambitions at that age, because almost from one day to the next, I did discover, I had like a paradigm shift on life. I started seeing everything differently, and suddenly I didn't feel like I needed my violin anymore. In fact, I would have just given it up, except that I had, thankfully, good advice from people close to me, like my now ex-husband was like, you shouldn't give up the violin. You've been doing this your whole life. Don't give up an art that you're good at. So I didn't quit, but I did drop the solo ambitions at that time and sort of grudgingly kept playing the violin. And that was an interesting process over a number of years, because I kept playing. I was concertmaster of some orchestras. I played in the back of the seconds in another orchestra. I played chamber music. I did a McDonald's commercial. It's like I did so many different kinds of things, but none of them were the one thing I had been focused on up until age 19, 20. Yeah. And my heart kind of went out of the whole thing in a sense. I wasn't really enjoying it in the same way that I was as a kid, where it was this natural urge that I had and real true desire that I kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater. And so,
I mean, all of those things that you just mentioned before the time you were 20, like that's quite ambitious and accomplished of you to be able to do all of those things. So
I just mentioned were after. Okay. After. But it's true. Before age 20, I had already played in Carnegie Hall twice. I had played with international orchestras and won international competitions. And so, yeah, I felt like I had kind of done it all in a way, although, of course, very, very far from having done it all. But there was this sense that I had kind of done what I wanted to do. And I just had other interests suddenly.
So, yeah. So you mentioned a shift when you were 19. So was there something specific that happened that opened that world up for you?
Well, I met my husband at the time, and he introduced me just to a universal perspective on life based on an awareness of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And it was that. It was the combination of falling in love with him, but the main thing that really changed everything was not that. It was suddenly realizing that what I had really wanted and loved about the violin was essentially the communication that I could have with people through my heart. Mm-hmm. And that's, then suddenly I had words for it, like, oh, that's my spiritual self. And I'm expressing that spiritual self from my heart with other people through my violin. But I don't need a violin to do that. So in a sense, my violin and music had been kind of like a religion up to that point. And suddenly I realized I didn't need that mode of expression, that there were other ways to have a spiritual life that didn't involve the violin.
Right.
So then I started exploring all that, and at the same time, still playing the violin, but not at all in the same way. And so that was a big, big change.
Yeah, because you were saying how like you were so focused on like competition and that drive, and then all of a sudden, like to have that approach of life like sort of trickle in, maybe those things kind of disappeared.
They did. And I also became more aware of the ego that was involved in wanting that. And I didn't really want to be like that. So that's why, in a sense, it was a bit of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It was my way of not dealing with the ego involved in being a solo performer. Just don't do it then. But that doesn't really solve the ego problem. It's just one aspect of it.
Right. When you were 19, were you like pursuing an education like in a collegiate level for your career, or what were you doing at that time?
Yes, actually, I went to the Cleveland Institute of Music when I was 16 and was there for 2 years and then transferred to Indiana University. Was there for 2 years. So I was halfway through my senior year of my bachelor's when my husband and I got married. So I got married really young. I was 20. And yeah, and it was just everything changed. halfway through my bachelor's, I got married, did the rest of my bachelor's through correspondence. I had one course left. It was Italian. So I was able to do that from Ithaca. I followed my husband to Ithaca because his first job was at Ithaca College, and just did everything from there, and then started getting interested in learning how to cook and take care of a household, which I knew nothing about at that And then started following him around to his job. So he was teaching theory. He's a theorist. He taught at Ithaca College first, and then we moved to Chicago. He got a job at Northern Illinois University, and I started freelancing in the Chicago area. Then he got a job teaching at Eastman, so we moved to Rochester, New York, and I started playing in the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. And then we moved to Cincinnati, where I still am, and he still is too. He got a job at the Cleveland, sorry, not Cleveland, the Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, the University of Cincinnati. And so he's still there. I live 5 minutes away. My kids are both at CCM. Actually, no, my older one just graduated. What am I saying? So all four of us have been associated with CCM. And
Wow, they're
yeah,
keeping
so that's kind of.
the family tradition alive.
Yes, and we're all musicians too.
So you mentioned that your husband like opened you up to this whole spiritual world, and as a musician, as both musicians, were you able to have a spiritual musical experience of creation together?
No.
Did you?
Although he did write some really beautiful pieces for me. One of them, so I guess you could say yes. I never really thought of it as a spiritual collaboration of any kind, but yeah, there's always spirit in music. So yeah, he wrote a wonderful piece for solo violin, well, violin and piano. It's called Songs of the Infinite, which is also on YouTube. And I really enjoyed playing that. I actually got to play that in recital at Carnegie Hall. And it was a recital of his music. And so I was able to perform that there. I have a really nice memory of that concert. It was the first time, actually, was it the first or the second time? I think it was the second time where I actually dared to perform barefoot at Carnegie Hall. It was a personal coup for me because I don't wear shoes during the day. I love to have my feet spread and be free and grounded. And I like to be barefoot outside when the weather permits. So it always felt wrong to be having my feet squished into shoes when I was expressing myself through the violin. And this was a while ago. Now people do that much more often, but at the time, like, nobody was really playing barefoot. So I felt very happy that I had the guts to do that at the time. It really helped me feel at home and comfortable on the stage at Carnegie.
So physicality seems to be like another element that you've kind of implemented into your life as far as the Alexander technique.
Absolutely.
So would you like to share how you discovered that and how that applies to everything?
Sure. Yeah. And talking about, bringing physicality into my life, I think when I was a kid, and even as a young adult, I was pretty out of touch with my body. I was very mental. I lived either with my head in the clouds daydreaming or reading books. That's like daydreaming, fiction, and or playing the violin. Or so I was very, in my head. And it wasn't until, I did go through a lot of, some years of not being very happy, and finally did find the Alexander technique. It was like an answer to my prayers when I was feeling really down. It was actually my third try at the Alexander technique. I didn't really click with it. I didn't like it at all the first two times. And actually, the time that worked was about 12 years after the first time I had tried the Alexander technique, because I had a good friend who told me, you really have to try one more time. You would love this. I know you would love the Alexander technique, Jennifer. You just need to find the right teacher. So I did find the right teacher, and it was at a time where I was having neck pain, and it wouldn't go away. I went to doctors, chiropractors, nothing really helped. And then I went to Alexander technique lessons, and they really not only healed the pain really quickly, but I started feeling just incredible in my whole body. And emotionally, I was uplifted and happy and falling in love with life again. And it was a dramatic shift. It was as dramatic as the shift we already talked about when I was 19 from quitting my solo career and getting married. That was major. But, but finding the Alexander technique was also very major. Again, it was like a paradigm shift where suddenly I was able to see the world and life through a different lens almost. Took on a completely different form where my body was included in everything. Suddenly I was aware of being in my body and feeling good and being able to move with less constriction. I mean, I remember so well one day coming home from lesson and watching my arm float up to a kitchen cupboard to get a glass, and I was just watching it move, and it was just floating with such ease and grace. It was almost like it wasn't my arm. It was really marvelous, and it was like, what is happening to me? I feel amazing. So I kept studying.
would you mind explaining to the listeners what the Alexander technique is, just in case like it's a new concept for them?
Sure, absolutely. Of course, there's so much to read about it online, but the way I teach it is actually really different from the way most people would. Like if any of my listeners have, if any of our listeners right now were, if they've done Alexander technique, it was probably hands-on with touch. And if they read about it online, they'll probably be reading about lessons with touch. Basically, Alexander technique was developed by Frederick Matthias Alexander. He was born in 1869, and he was an actor like you, actually. Yeah, I'm sure. Have you actually done some Alexander technique yourself?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, but I want to hear it in your words.
You know a little bit about it. Yeah. So, well, he had a performance issue as an actor, where he would go up on stage and get hoarse every time that he went to recite. And doctors and voice specialists couldn't help him. So he figured out that because it was only happening when he went to perform, when he went to recite, it must be something that he was doing to himself to cause that problem. And also because there was clearly nothing wrong with his voice. There was nothing wrong with the voice box, with the vocal mechanism. So he set about to figure out what he was doing to cause that problem. And the story goes that it took years of him watching himself in full length mirrors. Like he got three of those big mirrors and watched himself, which at that time people didn't have like we do now. So it was almost like me going out to buy scientific equipment. Right. So he got the full length mirrors and started watching himself. And at first he had no idea. He didn't see anything, but he kept with it. And that tenacity is actually one of the most incredible things about his story, is that even though he wasn't being able to solve the problem, he didn't give up. And he just was going on his gut, his instinct, and the intellectual working out of his problem. It's like, it was logical. If I only get hoarse on stage, I must be causing that. So if I'm causing it, I must be the one that has the solution. So I'd better figure it out because nobody else is going to do it for me. So
wow, like that.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Not many people do that.
No, they don't. So I really admire that he did that. And thankfully for all of us, he did. And he did cure his problem, And then he went on to have a successful acting career, and people started flocking to him to study with him. Like, how can I get a voice like that? Right? So he started teaching, and then he realized that everybody that came to him had the same issue that was just manifesting in different ways. And, you know, long story short, he discovered really important integral things about how the mind and body work together in the human organism that cause a person to have good coordination and therefore, you know, have everything work, you know, the systems work, their organs work, the thinking and the actions and the movements work easily, naturally. Like, you're either doing that or you're interfering with that by doing something which starts in the mind. And that's the aspect of the Alexander technique that I have been personally fascinated in for many years. The part about it where it's about how you're thinking. So he discovered he was thinking in a certain way that caused his body to pull down or compress or tighten to cause the hoarseness in his throat. And so once he realized the connection between his thinking and the results in the body, he was able to experiment with different ways of thinking to get different results in his body. And he discovered how to think in a way to let the body free up and do its thing naturally. So then he started teaching that to all kinds of people, became really famous, moved to London, and then he started a training course at some point where other people wanted to learn how to teach the way he was teaching. And at some point along the way, he started using his hands to speed up the process and make it more clear to his students what he was talking about. And so then he started doing more and more of the hands-on work, and that's what people really wanted to learn. So when he started training teachers to teach the Alexander technique, it was a training in how to use the hands to help people get back to that state of natural coordination and free movement. So the way I teach is really different, like I said, because I actually don't use my hands anymore. And I love to explore the connection between thoughts and words and energy, and not necessarily touching and using the kinesthetic connection. So that's how I can teach people online anywhere, all over the planet, which is really fun too.
Yeah, that's the mind-body connection is really fascinating.
Yes.
And so much of like our trauma like lives within our body.
Absolutely.
So is that an aspect that you like put into your work as well? Especially like if you're working specifically with performers and musicians.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Although the way that trauma work is included in my work is indirect and not explicit.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that I do trauma work. However, I do anything work. So pretty much students come to me for all kinds of reasons. The most common ones are performance anxiety, physical pain, excess tension, you know, things like carpal tunnel, tendonitis, back pain, neck pain, and also just feeling burned out or stuck, unmotivated, feeling like they're not making progress, wanting to advance their skills, their technique. So the musical artistry part of it too. Mm-hmm. But no matter why the musician comes initially, we really are working with the whole self. And so the student comes to a lesson, to my coaching programs, with the whole self, right? It's like, you can't just say, well, let's work on the violin and leave the trauma back in Kalamazoo or wherever. Right? You can't just come with part of you. As an artist, and when you really want to get to the next level, you have to just Well, there's no way to not bring your whole self, really. And what blocks us and causes problems, prevents our progress, is the false belief that we can separate ourselves and not bring everything. Now, when I say people bring their whole selves, that doesn't mean we ever have to talk about some things. You know, there are a lot of things we never, ever touch on. But when one aspect of a person's life improves through the work that we do, everything improves.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes really remarkable. Sometimes, you know, my students call it miraculous, and I'm not exaggerating, because it really does seem miraculous sometimes when somebody comes for a certain problem that they have and something else that was completely unexpected starts to open up and free up. And it's just really beautiful to watch. And you never know where things are going to go, but it is definitely going to go in a good direction once you get out of your own way.
Yeah. And so the initial like point would be, is focusing on the thoughts. Would you say that that's like the starting point of that process?
Almost. Yes. The very first place that I start with my students is actually, you know, we can do it right now, actually, as we're sitting here, you and me and everyone listening, we can just kind of bring our attention back to ourselves in this moment. And we can ask ourselves, what do I notice about my body right now? So we kind of start with what's already there. What's happening in me? What am I feeling? What's happening in my body? And then sometimes you feel great and everything's great. That's wonderful. But very often, once you start checking in with yourself, like tiny little aches and pains, little discomforts, little back pain here, neck pain there shows up. That's actually really common. Most people have that happen. Mm-hmm. So that's where we start. I feel like it's really, really important to start with where you are. You just bring your attention back. So much of the time our attention is scattered all over the place. And so the first step is to bring your attention back to yourself. And very importantly, to get curious. Get curious about what's actually happening with me right now. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's the first thing. And you know, there's more involved in this practice of noticing in the beginning. It's a practice that we call ima, and ima means now in Japanese. This is what I call a pre-awareness etude. After you learn ima, we do all kinds of awareness etudes after that. And this actually is in the context of something called Primal Alexander, which is the specific mode of Alexander technique that I teach, which was developed by my partner Mio Morales. And so those are the steps. So we start there, you start where you are, and then we go into the thinking, exactly what you said. So as soon as you can connect to what's actually happening, you can get curious about, okay, well, there's tension here, but what about, is there some easing in my body too? Is there a place in my body that feels fine? I can see you kind of getting curious.
Yeah. I'm thinking of like the awareness though, like the awareness of yourself, like having that awareness versus the ego of self, which we talked about earlier. And I was thinking about like your career and like competition and then like that opening up for you and how all of these things kind of connect to where you are now.
Yes. It's
really nice.
Interesting path. I absolutely love what I do now. It's constantly interesting, and my students are always inspiring me because everybody's exactly the same. We all have a mind and a body and emotions and a creative spirit, and yet everybody is completely different. It's so fun to see what people bring and what they can do to help themselves when they learn to think in a slightly different way, a more constructive way.
Yeah, so you learning the Alexander technique for yourself must have been profoundly motivating for you as far as like your own personal change, enough that you're teaching it to other people. Yes. So what benefits did the Alexander technique provide you as a person and performer? And
oh my gosh, so much, so much. So much that I don't even know where to start. Well, the first thing obviously was that my pain went away. The physical pain that I showed up that first lesson, pain in my neck went away. But at the same time, emotionally, I just started feeling so much happier and freer. My relationships started improving because I became less reactive and more consciously in control of my thoughts and my actions. I became much more curious. I think emotionally I had gradually started to deaden a little bit, where it's hard to describe, but I just wasn't interested in a lot of things anymore. I don't know. As a kid, I was very one-track minded, but I was also really driven to learn about the violin and music and all that. And I did fine in school, but it was never really that interesting. It was always about music, music, music.
Yeah.
And then when I dropped that, then I was interested in comparative religions and spirituality, and I learned and learned and learned. But then I got to a point where I was practicing things, meditation, for example, which is wonderful. And I continue to do that. And I think it's really, really important. And yet I got less interested in learning things. And there was a part of me that believed I shouldn't really be curious about things, that I needed to almost like live in my own insular little world, with my husband and family. Mm-hmm. And that I was supposed to be content with what I had, which in a certain way, yes, but in another way, no, this is a big wide world and there are other people and there's a lot of good we can do in the world. And there's just a lot to experience that you can bring your goodness to. And I kind of shut down in a way which was very unhealthy on every level. Then when I found the Alexander technique, it all started opening up in an amazing way.
Yeah, it seems to like integrate all the parts of yourself together.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people are like really hungry to learn things, but they never actually integrate those things into their body and That's into right. their like being. So
exactly. A lot of the learning we do stays intellectual, stays mm-hmm. up in the head. And yes, yeah. you can have great conversations about things. And ideas and concepts. But well, here's a good example. I always thought I was grateful. I would express gratitude, every day. I was a spiritual person. I wanted to be a good person and I knew I was supposed to be grateful. So I had my gratitude lists and, all those things. I did what I was supposed to do. And yet I was unhappy. And so then I felt really guilty mm-hmm. about being unhappy. It's like, you're supposed to be happy. You have all these things. You have this and you have that, and you should be grateful for what you have. That was like the constant refrain in my head that just made me more miserable. And it wasn't right away when I started the Alexander technique, but over time, the more I practiced it and the more things started integrating, like you said, the more I started embodying the things that I had been thinking, which were really good things. I had really good thoughts, but they were not embodied. I wasn't feeling mm-hmm. grateful in the way that you can if you actually let it sink into your whole body.
Yeah. I also think that you can't embody that until you're ready. Like, you have to be the one that allows that to happen. Like, it can't be forced on by someone else.
Absolutely. And I think having tools to help us do that is important too, whether it's meditation or mm-hmm. prayer or journaling, whatever a person uses as a tool, I think it's really important to have effective tools that help to integrate these things. so that when you're ready, you have the thing that you can do that makes it effective. I mean, people can do that naturally, but I think that's rare. I think having external support and ideas and help and tools is important.
Yeah, and I think also like having an understanding of why the tool is useful and can be integrated, especially because I'm thinking of like academic art and like studying the arts academically, because in my experience, they give you all these tools, like for example, even like the Alexander technique, like you'll have like a workshop about it, but like you don't understand how all of those things work together and how you can use those things to your advantage, to integrate them, to embody them for your whole self.
Yes, exactly. You just touched on a really, you know, a nerve for me. I write about it at length in my book that just came out. It was my experience. You know, we talked about the first Alexander lessons that I had, how miraculous and life-changing those were. But at the same time, I was extremely frustrated because I would go to my lessons, have this life-changing experience. I would be floating on air for the next couple days and everything was amazing, feeling so good. But then slowly I'd come back down to earth, you know, and things would start to feel heavy again. And my mood would start to go slowly down again. And that shining love of life just kind of got a little more cloudy again. And so I was desperate to go to my next Alexander technique lesson to get that experience again. And then I would need the next one. And yes, over time I was changing, but I had no idea what was going on, what was going on in those lessons. And my teacher is fantastic. The hands-on was just wonderful, or I wouldn't have had those experiences, and I'm forever grateful. But he was very quiet most of the time, and we didn't really talk much about the process. And so I didn't understand what was causing the changes. And a lot of the times it felt like it was because of the what the teacher was doing with those that gentle touch that I could not replicate on my own. Mm-hmm. And so I took 30 lessons, which was amazing. And then I decided, okay, I need to figure this out. Actually, before the 30 lessons were over, I went and got all of Alexander's books from the library. I read them all. I'm like, I need to figure this out. What's going on here? So I read them. I loved them. They made sense, but I couldn't connect what I was reading with what I was experiencing in the lessons. And they were not, it wasn't practically helpful for me to change anything. So then I thought, okay, well, obviously I need to do a teacher training because that's the only way I'm going to get this. So I never wanted to teach. I just wanted to understand how to get that experience for myself without depending on a teacher. Mm-hmm. So I went and did the 1600 hours of training over 3 years to get certified as an Alexander teacher. Thankfully, the deal with my husband was, we're going to pay so much money and you're going to be gone for 3 years. And so you better use this skill and teach when you're done. So that was the deal. And thankfully, halfway through the training, I fell in love with teaching. So that worked out really well. But, you know, even after 3 years of training, I was out there teaching it and I still didn't really understand how to do it for myself, which was just so frustrating. And it wasn't until I started experimenting with using my hands less and really wanting to help my students learn to do it for themselves. Because I was teaching at the university and they only allowed me to have my students for one semester, which I think is crazy, but that was how it was at the time. And there was nothing I could do about it. So I thought, these poor students are going to have a great semester, and then I'm dropping them because I'm not allowed to teach them any longer. So I want them to have something at the end of the semester that they can do to help themselves when they don't have my support anymore. So they can't become dependent on my touch. They need something that they can do. So I try to help them to think differently to get different results. And it started working, which was really exciting. But then what really changed everything for me and my teaching was when I met Mio. So my partner, Mio Morales, I met him at the International Congress for the Alexander Technique in Limerick, Ireland. And I always forget what year that was, but I think it was 8 years ago, whatever that is. So 2015.
Oh, that was 8 years ago.
I know, it's crazy. So I met him there, and it turns out that he had been teaching without his hands, without touch, for quite a few years, and he had developed a whole process for doing that that he was still developing and experimenting with. And so we hit it off. At that time, this was long before the pandemic, we were two of maybe a handful of people in the whole world, actually, who were experimenting with hands-free teaching. And so it was really fun to talk with someone who really knew what he was doing. At this point, he's been, you know, doing Alexander Technique for more than 50 years, so he's really a master teacher. So I started learning his process for teaching and learning and, you know, doing the Alexander Technique for myself, and it worked. And it's all about what you think is what you get. So get curious about what you're thinking. If you don't like the effects, then maybe you need to think differently. So start experimenting, and here is a way that you can try to think differently. And so there is a specific way that we help our students think differently, and we call it constructive thinking. And it is a specific way of thinking that does integrate your thinking with your body, with your emotions, with your whole self, with awareness. So from the very first day of working with me, my students can experience that, and they know exactly what they're doing to get the results they're getting, even in the first day. It's really, really simple and really easy.
That's really cool, that story, because like you were seeking something to find the answer, and now you're able to teach others because of that answer that you were seeking.
Yeah, I feel really, really fortunate. Life has sort of taken me along these steps, and I think it does for everybody, right? But yeah, I do feel really fortunate to be teaching what I wanted to learn.
Yeah. Wow. If people would like to work with you, like, do you take students online or individually? Yes. Or in a group setting, or how does that work?
Yeah, actually, since 2018, I've been exclusively online. So I have two main programs. I do a premium coaching private program. That's a 6-month coaching program. And all of my programs include some private, a group experience, and self-study courses that I've created. So I have the 6-month program, then I also have an introductory course that changes periodically. Sometimes it's focusing on performance anxiety, sometimes we're emphasizing pain or physical tension, and sometimes it's just a general integrative experience. I call it the musician's mind-body breakthrough. And so yeah, people can find me and just ask and get in touch with me. And I usually ask a person if they're an amateur or professional, because the process is exactly the same, but the languaging and the, you know, some of the goals that people have are a little different, you know, if they're an amateur or professional. But I work with all kinds of musicians, not just classical either, you know, from beginner amateurs to elite professionals, classical, non-classical, anything goes, because we're just people. I'm just working with a person.
Yeah. And I imagine the stresses of those two things are much different also.
Yeah, they're different. And yet you'd be surprised. Well, I doubt you'd be surprised, actually, because you're a musician. I was going to say, you might be surprised that, you know, people who are really at the top of their game can be nervous just like a beginner amateur, you know. And so even though it can seem like we're really different, we're all dealing with the same stuff, imposter syndrome.
I was exploring the word amateur the other day, because I like to do that sometimes, like the etymology of words. and amateur, like ama, it comes from the heart. And so like in our culture, like it's become like had a different connotation almost, because amateur is like, oh, you're not good enough to get paid for it, you're not professional. But that's, it has to start from like that heart place in order for you to even be able to get to the professional place. Yeah,
everyone who's a professional used to be an amateur.
Yeah.
You have to start by being an amateur. And I think a lot of the times that amateurs are really lucky, because they're doing it consciously because they love it. And not everyone starts that way. Sadly, there are a lot of people who were forced to play instruments that really didn't want to. That's a different story. But it's sad to watch sometimes when people love music and they have these wonderful aspirations to become a professional. And then at some point, something happens to a lot of people that turns them off. And that can be really heartbreaking for people. And then at the same time, there are professionals who've gotten to a high level and it can become just a job.
Yeah.
And it's like that spark, that magical love heart spark that attracted people to music to begin with, that inspired them to get where they are, has kind of been snuffed out mm-hmm. by the routine or the need to make money or the survival. Yeah, all of that. There's so many reasons it happens, but a lot of my students do come to me feeling really unhappy with where they are in their musical careers. I'm thinking right now of the professionals. And unfortunately, a lot of them come to me as a last resort. I wish they would come to me as a first resort, because it would save them sometimes years of angst. But sadly, most of them end up trying, they'll have pain and they go to the doctor, which of course I recommend anyway, but they'll go to the doctor and a lot of them will get surgeries that are unnecessary, or they'll go to the chiropractor and massage for week after week after year, and they're feeling miserable. So they go to the therapists and the counselors year after year after year. And then finally, they're about to give everything up and they hear about me and they come to me and say, well, I think I'll try one last thing. And if this doesn't work, I give up. And it works. And they're always telling me, I wish I had found you 10 years earlier.
Yeah. I wish like these things were integrated more into like our training programs and like conservatory style, like learning of like how to care for us as whole humans, because we are the artists, like we are the instrument, we are the channel for that thing. And if we don't take care of ourselves, then like breaking us down like military style is not going to like do anything except prepare us for the professional world, I guess. But
no, you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you. And thankfully, there are a lot of institutions that do have a class or two.
Right.
But the problem is the overall attitude in most places hasn't really changed in maybe 100 years, or is changing very slowly. Mm-hmm. And, what you just said is so important, that, and I do think that singers are much more conscious usually than instrumentalists, just because your body is your voice, is your instrument. You are your instrument. You know that. The problem with instrumentalists is we are our instruments too, and we don't know it, because we think that the violin is the instrument. But it's like, no matter what your mode of self-expression is, your primary instrument is you, yourself, mm-hmm. your whole self. And that's what we need to work on first. I just marked this in my book, because I have a term that I've come up with that I wanted to share. If it came up, it's coming up.
Yay.
I call it primary practice. Primary practice is the practice of noticing and prioritizing the quality of awareness that you bring to your experience of your whole being as you engage in any given activity at any given moment. So basically, it's saying that we need to be practicing noticing and prioritizing our awareness of ourself. And that's something we practice all of our waking hours, whether we know it or not. And so we might as well know it and practice how we're using our whole selves consciously so that we can get better at it and we can be more integrated and less reactive and just more responsive and freer. That's something we have to practice when we walk down the street or when we brush our teeth or when we do the dishes or when we call a friend on the phone. We need to be conscious, what's happening to my instrument as I'm doing these things? Mm-hmm. And then if I pay attention to that and I become a better observer of myself, over time, I become much more sensitive to when I am interfering with my natural coordination and when I'm blocking my true authentic self-expression. And then when I'm aware that I'm interfering, I can learn how to stop interfering and let things flow. And that's where that flow state comes from. Yeah. That's what makes art flow and inspired and easeful and effortless. And that's what I teach my musicians to get to step by step.
Beautiful.
And it's fun too.
Yeah. So speaking of your book, if people would like to purchase it and learn more about your teaching and your style of delivery to get to the authentic self, where can they find that?
Well, it's available on Amazon right now. And the full title of the book is Make Great Music with Ease, The Secret to Smarter Practice, Confident Performance, and Living a Happier Life. And right now, it is available in paperback and I believe in ebook form. The audiobook is my winter project or spring project. I'm hoping to narrate it myself, which nice. Is a challenge, but people can get on the wait list for that if they want.
Well, if you need any help with that, I have done a lot of audiobooks, so I can be a
Ooh, thank
coach
you.
For that, if you like.
I'll have to talk to you about that. Thank you.
So I will put all of those links into the show notes so people can find your book really easily.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So I have one last question that I ask to kind of like wrap up the conversation.
Yeah, sure.
Because we're coming up on time, I think. Mm-hmm. And that question is, if your inner voice had a billboard, what would it say to the world?
Ah, that's so funny. As soon as you said it, I said, be yourself.
There you go.
Yeah, there it is. If I could just add a little bit to that, because I do talk about that in my book, that's the answer that came, but it's also the answer my father used to give to me as I was growing up, as I was a kid. I was reading a little bit about you, and I think we have this in common too, that we were both extremely shy as children. Yes. Like, I was always terrified to speak in public. Mm-hmm. Like this would have just, I never would have done this, like not even remotely. Alexander Technique helped a lot with that. But whenever I had difficulty, my father used to say, Jennifer, just be yourself. And I thought it was a great idea, but I had no idea how to do that. I found it terribly difficult to be myself around anybody, mm-hmm. except, you know, my family, right? I couldn't be myself around other kids, around teachers. Like, I just couldn't be myself around other people. And so for me, that's been pretty much a lifelong quest in a way to figure out how to be myself. And you know, I think I'll be working on that until I die, but I think I'm a lot better at it now. And I think I have a much better understanding of how to be yourself, which is first of all recognizing that you're already yourself, and who else could you be? So allowing yourself to just let go of the extra stuff.
Yeah.
That can be really terrifying, but little by little by little, to learn to soften and quiet mm-hmm. and then listen to that mm-hmm. quiet inner voice mm-hmm. that yeah. really is your true self.
Yeah, and peel back the layers and uncondition, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me and sharing all your wisdom. I had a lot of fun on this one.
Oh, thank you so much, Whitney. It's been such a pleasure talking with you, and I love your questions and diving into all of these, you know, these topics that I love to speak about.
Thank you so much for joining me this week. If you're listening and you like what you hear, please consider subscribing and rating this podcast, as it really helps get this podcast out to other people who might be interested in hearing it but don't know about it yet. And also, if you'd like to contact me or reach me, you can reach me at unconditioningpodcast@gmail.com or unconditioningpodcast on Instagram. Thank you so much, and until next time, stay tuned in to you.